From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! Who speaks for God? On this Christmas Day, a conversation with Christian activists. No, not the Christian Coalition, but progressive church leaders.
When we baptize babies at our church, or adults as well, we will say, in the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Ghost, one God, Mother of us all.
In the last century, evangelical Christians, and I regard myself as an evangelical preacher, even though that word sends shockwaves out around the country these days, evangelicals were abolitionists. They were leaders in the anti-slavery battle. They were tireless advocates of the poor and the oppressed. They were behind many child labor laws. They were feminists, and they were pro-labor, pro-working people. They were decidedly anti-corporate.
And the oh-so-politically correct players remake It's a Wonderful Life.
You've heard about the new workfare requirements, haven't you? Well, if you want your measly $130 monthly benefits, then you'll need to work 35 hours a week somewhere. And since you can't find a job in anywhere that pays you, I guess you'll just need to work for me for free.
What? Are you crazy? You fired me, and now you want to hire me back for nothing?
All that and more coming up on this holiday edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Any media discussion about Christians, Christianity, or Christian political activism inevitably seems to focus on right-wing evangelical groups like the Christian Coalition. Everything from opposition to abortion to gay bashing are often presented as mainstream Christian responses. Today on Democracy Now!, we look at another kind of Christian political activism, one that defends women's rights and that seeks to feed the hungry, house the homeless, and empower the poor. We're going to begin with two people, Reverend Dr. James Forbes, the head of New York's Riverside Church, one of the largest multicultural congregations in the country. Unlike many mainline evangelical churches, the Riverside Church has taken a leading role in fighting for social justice. We're also joined by Dr. Dolores Williams, a professor of theology and culture at Union Theological Seminary in New York. She's the author of Sisters in the Wilderness. Dr. Williams, you advocate womanism. Can you explain what this philosophy is?
Womanism is a theological and lay expression by African-American women and women of color. And what we try to do within the confines or constructs of womanism is to bring African-American women's experience to the forefront of theological discourse. And we've done this in several ways. We've done it through sermons, as there are many womanist ministers now in churches in the United States. We've done this theologically. That means in theological seminaries, where I teach a course in womanist theology. And courses in womanist theology have been taught at Harvard and other divinity schools and theological schools across the country. But the primary goal of womanism, as I see it, is to introduce the world of religion to the kinds of contributions African-American women have made, not only to the development of an expression of religion in the African-American church, but also to the civil rights movements and the activist movements of black people in this country. So womanism is, we claim our roots both in feminist discourse and in our African-American heritage. And from that, certain kinds of constructs and meanings are yielded that bespeak the experience of African-American women.
Can you give an example of how you've introduced it into theological thought and teaching?
Well, one of the ways we've, on two levels. First, in the professional arena of academic societies where theologians and religious scholars come to read papers. We have a group there called the Womanist Theologians, and what we do is to read papers about on themes that have to do with African-American women's experience in religion. On one level, that's one level that we on which we officiate. The next is in the parish, there are women who have consciously try to integrate womanist themes into their sermons, into their interpretation of biblical events and experiences, and into the liturgy as a whole. There's also an activist strand of womanism in the religious arena, and that has expressed itself primarily through our participation in certain kinds of community organizations. For instance, now I'm involved with HIT, which is Harlem Initiative Together, and our purpose is, and Professor Forbes is active in that too, and our purpose is to, in HIT, is to pressure or put some pressure on public officials and public policy to be more attentive to the kinds of issues that the people who live in the Harlem community themselves raise and to develop actions around those issues. HIT is an affiliate in some sense, or it's related to the Industrial Areas Foundation. And another kind of activist move that some of us womenists have made is to align ourselves with those groups in the community that are actively working with women who are facing alternative stances to incarceration, one being in New York here in Harlem, the Green Hope Project.
Which is
located in Harlem on Uptown on East First Street, and that is a facility that houses and has programs for women who would be incarcerated, but their whatever their misdemeanor was, it wasn't. It's not serious enough for behind bars, but it is serious enough for certain kinds of rehabilitative things to happen and to help the women, in other words, gain citizenship or activism into or active movement into the larger society.
Before we go to Dr. Forbes, how has the mainstream church received womanism? What's their response to it?
You know, there's been, it's not as, it, I can't say that across the board it's been a very productive response. The response has been different. According to the congregation, according to the way that the organization or the church itself has responded to women's issues generally. We've had a lot of support, though, for we do get a lot of support from people who are in, men who are in the academic world who teach with us. We've gotten support from some men who are in the pulpits, too, or who are in churches. But one of the problems tends to be the dispute between power and authority in the church. Who's going to have the power and the authority, and who's going, is it going to be an androcentric or male-modeled ministry that uses primarily male language and male images, or is it going to be a kind of ministry that tries to use both male imagery and female imagery to talk about the divine?
Reverend James Forbes, what is Riverside Church in that regard?
I believe Riverside Church is an affirming church. It affirms that women and of any color, that they have had experiences, and that anyone who seeks to tell the truth, who has not heard and responded to the truth which comes from women, that they have only very partial truth and indeed a distorted truth. Therefore, in our worship services, we seek to be inclusive in language. I even remember preaching a sermon one time, "Would your God want to be called Mother?" When we baptize babies at our church, or adults as well, we will say, in the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Ghost, one God, Mother of us all. What that is designed to do is to tell a fuller truth, that God is not a male, God is not a female. If you're going to use language like that, you have to be as balanced as possible. So I think we approach it that way, but it's not just the language, it is the staff. And so that at our church, we have made an effort to see to it that women are included at every level of leadership, whether that is the staff in terms of executive minister. I'm a man, my executive minister is a woman. On committees, people will not stand for committees to be staffed primarily by either men or women. We put forth real effort to make sure that the leadership ranks are inclusive. And insofar as the language or the values we teach, if there is any indication of a kind of male hierarchical understanding, then we want to be vigilant about that. So we are partners with our womanist colleagues in ministry.
Yet, I assume that your training was not that way, or was it, in your church?
Well, in my early background, I remember participating in the discussion around whether the church would consecrate its first woman bishop. That was a fierce argument. And the men stood up against that in general, except that some women went on out and organized themselves and got a council together and decided they were going to bish anyway, whether the men consented to it or not. So that surely the movement actually came into being in response to the conflict between what the gospel was saying and the practices that people experienced in their congregations.
Reverend Forbes, why did you go into the ministry?
I went into the ministry because I felt I was called to do it. Now, I'll remind you, I'm the son of a preacher. And when I was a kid, everybody said, he's going to be a preacher just like his daddy. I developed a very negative response to that and decided, oh no, I'm going to be a medical doctor for two reasons. If you're a preacher, they try to run your life for you. And furthermore, they don't pay you enough to do that. So I wanted to take another approach. But as I grew up, went to college, by the end of my junior year, majoring in chemistry towards medical school, it became clear to me that my fulfillment would come as I would minister in a broader sense. So I'm still hopefully a healer, but what I would like to do is heal the spirits of people, to heal brokenness in urban situations, to heal the divisions between people of varying sexual orientations, of various theological perspectives, between various faith components. So I guess maybe I would say that I think maybe I got the impression that the God who made me was invested in my finding my fulfillment in this form of service.
Let's bring Jim Wallace into this conversation. Jim Wallace, who's written the book, Who Speaks for God? An Alternative to the Religious Right, A New Politics of Compassion, Community, and Civility. This book was clearly written in reaction to the rise of the Christian right. Now, these aren't the voices we're hearing right now. How did this alternative approach develop, this alternative to the religious right?
Well, I think we want to begin by saying that that Ralph Reed and Pat Robertson and others are really modern-day revisionists. They are people who have put certain ideological, political convictions ahead of what the Bible is saying, and in that sense, they're out of step even with that biblical tradition that my colleagues and I would want to claim for ourselves as well. For example, in the last century, evangelical Christians, and I regard myself as an evangelical preacher, even though that word sends shockwaves out around the country these days, evangelicals were abolitionists. They were leaders in the anti-slavery battle. They were tireless advocates of the poor and the oppressed. They were behind many child labor law movements. They were feminists. They were in the forefront of the women's movement in that period. And they were pro-labor, pro-working people. They were decidedly anti-corporate. So 100 years ago, evangelical meant something very different than it does today. So we've been hijacked, if you will, by a certain kind of polyester Christianity, which really is not faithful, in my view, to that more radical, biblical, populist tradition. And so a number of us thought that we ought to offer a different voice, because every time Dan Rather said Christian activists on CBS News, he meant the activists in the Christian Coalition. Well, my colleagues on the show and I, we've been Christian activists for most of our lives, and they, the Christian Coalition, do not represent us. They do not represent most Christians. So we thought another voice was necessary, and so we began to offer one of what we now call the Call to Renewal.
Considering there's so much activism, progressive activism, how is it that the Christian right gains so much strength and now gets so much attention?
Well, that's a good question. I think part of it was the most clever, very successful use and, in some ways, I would say, manipulation of the media in many, many years. They claim that the lack of coverage of their agenda was due to a sort of liberal media, as they would say, rejection of religion, and so the media became very defensive and began to cover them and really made people like Jerry Falwell and Pat Robertson household words, number one. Number two, they have lots of money. They've got lots of funding. But number three, they've done a lot of good organizing. They've done, in some ways, harder and better organizing than many on the progressive side, and that's been, I think, a real a goad to a new kind of organizing now at the local level. But I think also there has been, I think, a confusion in the land for a long time about religion. The evangelical world has gotten trapped in a kind of a conservative mindset, which really is distinctly different from that biblical tradition that the three of us would certainly come out of on this show.
You're the founding editor of Sojourners magazine, so you're really actually a part of the press as well. What is the overall philosophy of Sojourners?
Well, to get Dr. Williams and Reverend Forbes writing for us as often as possible, that's one. We have people like them writing for us, offering a very different kind of view of the intersection of faith and politics and culture. That's what we write about. And so it's offering a progressive Christian voice. We pull together evangelicals, leaders from the black churches, Catholics, and mainline Protestants, and try to offer a different kind of voice. It's a magazine that talks about putting faith into action. So we don't talk about ideas for their own sake, but only as they can lead us to put our faith, give life to our faith on the streets, or put feet to our prayers in the real world, as my colleagues were just talking about.
Do you cover the Christian right as well?
The original investigative pieces about the rise of the Christian right back in 1976, before they were really a blip on the media screen, they became prominent around 1980. But they were organizing in the late 70s, and we began some investigative work on them way back at that time. As I say, they really hijacked the term, the label evangelical, which these basically were fundamentalist Christians. There's a real difference between fundamentalists and evangelical, which is a broader, more biblical tradition. And the fundamentalists sort of hijacked the term evangelical. And really, there were meetings in the late 1970s between a number of the preachers, Robertson, Falwell, and some others, with people like Richard Viguerie and Paul Weyrich. These meetings were in, I suppose, non-smoke-filled rooms in Washington, D.C., but they made deals for political power, and Richard Viguerie was given names of all of the television preachers' mailing lists, you see, and he turned his computers on those names, and that was the beginning of what we now know as the Christian right.
I was very taken with the quote you have of Pat Robertson in the first chapter, Pat Robertson of the 700 Club, saying the Constitution of the United States, for instance, is a marvelous document for self-government by Christian people. But the minute you turn the document into the hands of non-Christians and atheistic people, they can use it to destroy the very foundation of our society.
Well, he also says our government's been taken over by termites, I think he calls them. He means liberals. Termites have taken over our government. It's time, he says, for a godly fumigation.
And he says that the Constitution of the United States says nothing about the separation of church and state, and that phrase does appear only in the Soviet Constitution.
Well, he calls the separation of church and state a Soviet lie at one point, which is really an amazing thing, because most Americans believe that there ought to be a separation of church and state. Doesn't mean that religious values ought to be outside of our public debate. On the contrary, we need the kind of values and spirit that faith brings to our public discourse. But the separation of church and state, I think, is really undermined by those kinds of quotations that you mentioned from Pat Robertson.
When we come back, we're going to be joined by the fourth member of our panel today. We'll be joined by Dr. Jack Shelton, an ordained minister in the Presbyterian Church and a Christian activist, I think we can say, in Alabama. But right now, we are going to break for a minute. We are speaking with Reverend Dr. James Forbes, who is the head of the Riverside Church here in New York City, senior minister here. And we're talking to Dr. Dolores Williams, professor of theology and culture at the Union Theological Seminary, a leading proponent of womanism. And on the phone with us from Detroit is Jim Wallace, who is author of Who Speaks for God? An Alternative to the Religious Right, A New Politics of Compassion, Community, and Civility. We'll be back on this Christmas special in a minute. You're listening to Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. And on this Christmas Day, we're talking about Christian activism, but not the way the rest of the media talks about it. We're not as much talking about Pat Robertson and Ralph Reed as we are talking to progressive activists about their work. And we're joined by Reverend Dr. James Forbes of the Riverside Church here in New York City, a multicultural congregation, one of the largest in the country. We're joined also by Dr. Dolores Williams, who is a professor at the Union Theological Seminary in New York. Jim Wallace is also with us. His book is Who Speaks for God? And we're joined by Dr. Jack Shelton, an ordained minister in the Presbyterian Church. He doesn't preach every Sunday, but one might consider his ministry to be the Program for Rural Services and Research, which he organized in 1979 at the University of Alabama. Can you tell us a little about this, Dr. Shelton?
Well, yes, I was fortunate enough to be able to organize a program that would allow the University of Alabama to share its resources with rural communities through mutually beneficial partnerships. And I was also put in a position in which I could be an advocate for the concerns and needs and ideas of people who lived in rural Alabama. And our work has focused in part upon medical issues and community development issues, but in recent years we have worked very closely with many of the small rural public schools in Alabama. The notion there is that these schools are, despite what you might think, these schools are often very common ground often across racial lines, certainly across economic lines. And there are places where young people are needed and valued, and even if the academic outcomes are not always the best, although frequently they are very good, young people have a chance to be participants, to take responsibilities, to undertake service that is meaningful to their communities, and in the process develop the kind of self-esteem and sense of capacity that is important if you're going to talk about democracy and people participating in democracy and taking an active role in it.
Dr. Shelton, especially in the South, the church is a powerfully conservative institution. I don't know if it's that different from the North, but that's certainly the stereotype. It's also an extremely segregated institution. How do you deal with that?
In some ways, I suppose over a lifetime, you just live with it. You know that that characterizes a lot of the churches. in my lifetime, I've been an ordained minister now for 40 years, and in my lifetime, I have seen the symbols and metaphors of change in the church. There are integrated congregations, and there are efforts. They are definitely not at the heart of Southern religion, but they are here. And so I suppose you spend as much of your energy and your time and your hopes in trying to change that. But that's a lot of the way it is.
I wanted to talk about politics and religion and how people made the leap. Dr. Williams, you leaped from political activism, from the civil rights movement, into the ministry. Why did you choose to go into it?
I don't think I chose to go into it. It sort of chose me. I'm not an ordained minister. I usually say that I'm a lay person because I like to minister from the pews rather than from the pulpit. But I had, during the civil rights movement, I had those civil rights movement in my part of the world, which was Kentucky and some of the parts of Tennessee, that the civil rights movement was very much activated and led by young people who were part of the NAACP Youth Council. And we had not put as much reliance upon the church as an advocate for what we were doing in terms of social integration as some of the other southern locations had. But I had sort of given up on the church as a viable support for civil rights action until I came to New York. And in New York, when Black Liberation Theology came out, and when I began to read that, I said, at last, somebody is saying something that has some relevance.
And explain what you mean by Black Liberation Theology.
Black Liberation Theology is a theology that emerged in 1969 in America with the work of Dr. James Cone. And he did a book called Black Theology and Black Power, in which he brought to the theological arena what hadn't been there before. And that was a lens through which to view African-American experience in relation to what Black people in the Black churches are, and even in the civil rights movement or activist movement, had understood God and Jesus to be. And I began to read that material, and I just went over to Union where he taught and started sitting in classrooms. And I sort of, it's the activism that pulled me into ministry more than it was anything that the Bible said or any particular message that I had heard that was a unique way of framing the gospel. It was strictly activist politics that pulled me into ministry, and I began to see that there was a viable way for the religion of our people to support what we as African Americans had done in the civil rights movement. And I became acquainted with what I hadn't known before in my college training. I had not been introduced to the history of the African American religious experience. And I got that when I went to Union with Black Theology. And then I began to see that we had been activists all along in our religion, and we had used our religion that way, and had understood that to be the gospel, that the equality, the justice that we fought for was what Jesus was all about. So I began to see a connection between my own Black roots and a gospel that was viable and could support a kind of political movement that I had found viable and supportive for my life and for my children's lives. So that brought me to ministry, and I'm still ministry in a way. I'm a lay minister in a way that questions about everything. I question the relevance of certain biblical texts and certain biblical passages. I do raise the question of the value of certain doctrines for African Americans, given what our experience has been and continues to be in the United States.
Like?
And I have raised a lot of question about the doctrine of atonement, which is a very important doctrine for the Christian church. And the reason I raise that is not because I was just trying to be cute and raise something that would be radical. It was because of the violence, so much of the violence that we have been beneficiaries, if that's a word to use, of in this country, caused me to begin to use violence as a way to look at text and to ask about the death of Jesus as a violent act that had been, as I had always learned it and as it's still taught, is that the death of Jesus was ordained by the Father, the murder of an innocent man for the redemption of sin. And my position was that this is, I don't think we can give a sacred status to violence. So that I begin to raise certain kinds of questions. And I don't think there's a thing wrong with that. I think one of the things that we as African Americans perhaps need to do more that we don't do, and that is to take very critical view of what we believe doctrinally and begin to do something with that in terms of our liberation struggle.
Reverend Forbes, you have been noted as one of the 12 most effective preachers in the English-speaking world by Newsweek magazine. How do you respond to those who say reverends, ministers, religious people should stay out of politics?
My first response is that people who do not understand that religion, by its very nature, has to be comprehensive, will often think of religion from a narrow band that has to do with personal piety or either simply with worship and ignore other dimensions of life. So my first thought is, how can we broaden the understanding which people have of what religion is supposed to be about?
Is that how you came into it, or did you slowly develop this?
No, I've always understood that in my faith, which was Pentecostal by background, you wanted at least to think that your God offered comprehensive coverage, not just what happened to you in church or what happened to you in terms of your personal struggles, but because the context in which we lived made a great impression on us, and that the capacity to affirm ourselves and to be productive for society required that we be nurtured in structures which made that kind of positiveness possible. So I've always had a sense that if God was the God of the whole earth, God was not going to be banished to some corner of some prayer meeting, but that people out of the prayer meeting with a vision sharpened by the sense of divine love would go forth to be engaged in social, economic, and political activities. Therefore, each ministry has to find its avenue of expression. Some of us specialize in preaching, but if our preaching does not have political implications, it is not the gospel. Some of us specialize in community organization, others in theological education, some of us in terms of political expressions in terms of office holding. So I ask people, don't tell the Holy Spirit how to assign a preacher. Let the Holy Spirit assign some of us for Congress, some of us for state houses, some of us for municipal buildings, some of us for agencies, and others of us primarily involved in releasing the gifts of congregations so they can take their role in these arenas. So the separation is ludicrous and reflects the absence of understanding of the depth of religion, which is to bind us together, and that involves both personal all the way to cosmic.
What do you think are the most important political issues to address now?
The most important political issue to address now is the issue of welfare reform, to see how we can make sure that it is not welfare reform or repeal. That is to say, the most important issue is the one that's glaring at me, and my conviction is that a fundamental shift has taken place in this nation. It is no longer clear to me that most of the politicians believe that we are our brothers and sisters' keepers. They seem to think that it is possible for one segment of the community or one racial group to flourish while ignoring those who are on the margins or who are living at subsistence level. My belief is that the economic system that I have derived many benefits from must show cause why it may not be considered the enemy of God if it neglects God's children who have not been able to fend for themselves. And in this current mood we are into, I'm watching and scrambling to find a way. How does the church say, no, it is not a genuine democracy, not even a democracy based on the documents of our founding mothers and fathers. It is not authentic Americanism if we consider that people who are poor are expendable, and that their health needs need not concern the government, that their educational and their employment needs can be ignored, their housing needs can be ignored. So from my perspective, this year, now you're talking about this year we're going to have to find out, is America really America? And is it America for all the people? And is our economy strong enough not only to make profitability for corporations and individuals, but is it strong enough to make sure that even if we see people falling through the safety net, there is a survival pad? That's the most important issue at this time that's going to affect the future of our nation as we move into a 21st century. If we don't deal with it, my conviction is we will not have as much to celebrate when the new millennium comes.
Jim Wallace, what do you think is the most important political issue to address today?
Same as Jim Forbes. I think welfare reform in the aftermath is the critical question facing us now. I've just been to about 35 cities across the country, and that's where we've got to bring people together, particularly in the religious community, and service providers have to come together as we haven't for a long time. We have to create a whole new paradigm at the local level now. There are critical things that have to be done. It's not just, we can't just keep saying that welfare reform bill was a terrible bill. We've said that over and over again, and it was. Now the question is how to organize locally to not allow a real disaster to occur. Now, along with that, you can't talk about economic justice and poor people's questions without dealing with the issue of racism in this country. A new conversation on race is critical now at the local level. Those two issues in tandem will be, I think, the cutting edge for us. And indeed, there's nothing more central to the Bible than these questions. The prophets make absolutely clear that a nation's integrity or righteousness is most determined by how we treat the poorest and most vulnerable. If that's not clear in the Bible, nothing is clear in the Bible. And the politics of racial healing, I think, has to be on the top of our agenda. Those are the issues. The call to renewal, this organization that many of us are involved in now, a new coalition, is going to address itself to.
Explain this coalition.
Well, we're, as I say, evangelicals, Catholics, African-American church leaders, and mainline Protestants have come together to form this call to renewal. Reverend Forbes and I signed an initial statement, the cry for renewal, last, I guess, 18 months ago now, and launched that in Washington, D.C. It's grown ever since, and now across the country, coalitions, new coalitions are forming that include those for families, if you will, in the churches, but reaching out beyond the churches as well to other traditions and those who are not particularly religious but believe that, in fact, politics must embrace our spiritual values as well.
What lesson do you think, and let's turn to Dr. Jack Shelton on this one, do you think you can learn from the Christian right?
The Christian right has been successful in terms of its strategies, and it understands, as someone, I believe Dr. Forbes said earlier, it understands how to manipulate, and it understands how to use the media. I don't think there's a lot to understand, but I think there's a lot to understand from the rise of an approach which seems to me to have blinded a lot of people from the concerns, particularly that have just now been enumerated, about the status of the poor in this country. I think that what has happened is there has been a reversal. The church, in its theology, is always to be measured by the situation of the poor. And one of the things that I think has happened is that the entrance into politics of in such a dominant way by what are called the right-wing groups, it has covered that over. And I think part of their success has been by just avoiding the situation that so many people in this country who are poor or who are dispossessed face. And it makes things very convenient. I mean, you don't listen to Mary singing the Magnificat. You don't dig into the biblical text to understand how much the church is is under judgment by corporately because of the status of the poor in this country or wherever. And I'd like to make a comment about something you asked earlier, and that's about the church being in politics. The church is always in politics. It's never been out of politics. And it's really specious to assume that the church is not political. All sermons are political. They may not be overtly political, but they either have to do with the status quo or the changing of the status quo. And the church is a very, very political institution, and it may not always act self-consciously like that, but it always is.
We're going to break one more time for another minute, and then when we come back, we'll wrap up. And I want to ask you each about the issue of family values, which has certainly come to be the dominant theme of politics today. We're talking to Dr. Jack Shelton, a minister with the Presbyterian Church, runs the Program for Rural Services and Research at the University of Alabama. We're also joined by Jim Wallace, who is the founding editor of Sojourners and who wrote the book Who Speaks for God. And in our studio here in New York, the Reverend Dr. James Forbes, who is a Baptist minister and heads up as senior minister at the Riverside Church here in New York City. And we're joined by Dr. Dolores Williams, a professor of theology and culture at Union Theological Seminary. You're listening to Democracy Now! We'll be back in 60 seconds. Listening to Democracy Now!, this Christmas Day special edition of Democracy Now!. I'm Amy Goodman, and I wanted to turn now to Dr. Dolores Williams on this issue of family values. How do you define family values?
I see family values basically as those values, mores, that a particular culture, tries to inculcate into a group of people who live together through by virtue of either kinship ties or some kind of social ties. That's what I see family. Values have to do with what we've taught our, and I always think of children because I'm the mother of four children. I'm a single parent mother of four children. The kinds of values are the ways we teach our children about life, the value of life, the value of the human, the values, the way we teach our children to take care of, to support their own survival, the survival of others, and to help our children and the people who live within our general group develop a positive, productive quality of life that does not live and survive and thrive on the basis of its own selfishness, but on the basis of its own ability to share with others and other groups and family units that are trying also to develop a quality of life that is positive for all members. Now, I think that one of the unfortunate things I think that has happened is that this whole notion of family values has gotten to be a term that's bantered about primarily in the conservative area with the right to mean something like a general knowledge that we're supposed to have, and everybody is supposed to inculcate the values associated with that knowledge to their children, regardless of the culture from which the family group comes, regardless of the kinds of traditions, whether they are religious traditions, cultural traditions that a people have, that somehow there's this network of values that are supposed to, in some sense, determine the way we behave in the world. And this network, or this way we behave in the world, of course, is going to get its energy primarily from a larger group out here, the group in power that would stereotype what family values might mean.
What were your thoughts on the whole Defense of Marriage Act, the bill that put into law that only a man can marry a woman, and that's the only legitimate nuclear family?
I thought it was perfectly ludicrous. I thought it was a way for power to try to change and, in fact, set back some of the kinds of progressive moves that have been made in the last 15 or 20 years in terms of family units and who's part of a family unit. I don't think that we can anymore say that same-sex marriages are definitely beyond what a democratic society can support at all.
Dr. Forbes, how did you deal with that issue?
I remember the expression in our church was that, you know, what God has joined, let no one put asunder. And one preacher was telling folks, now, you don't come up here with somebody and then later on tell me God didn't join you together, because I'm going to marry whoever comes up here who believes that God has joined them together. Now, that was way back I learned that. Now, in the light of this bill, my understanding is that people have freedom to choose that which they consider to be the partner that God has given them for the fulfillment and enrichment of life, and that they have chosen to live that together. So when such people come together, I think the real issue is, do we trust our ideology more than the spirit of genuine love that people claim inside themselves? So I believe that people ought to make their choices, and that people who are in religious communities should seek to bless the genuineness of that love and to protect the freedom and love of such persons. So, which being interpreted is, I think that same gender marriages are a part of the new frontier, and that people in the churches will begin to deal with it in more positive ways than they have in the past.
Have you married any gay men or lesbians?
We call it bonding ceremonies, and yes, I have participated in a bonding ceremony.
Jack, in Alabama, what was what were you doing any organizing around or response to the Defense of Marriage Act?
When the sort of the news about that broke and the temperature rose on that, I think one of the things I thought about was the tremendous pressure marriage by any definition is under and how difficult it is in a transitory society like we live in for people to maintain relationships, and it sort of forced me to have a look overall at the possibilities of people living together effectively, whether it's man or wife or in communities with each other.
Before I asked you, Reverend Jack Shelton, about the segregated churches of the South, Reverend Forbes, you're a Baptist. The Southern Baptists have perhaps the most racist history of any church in terms of endorsement of slavery and opposition to civil rights. How do you speak to that within your own denomination?
Recently, there has been an effort on their part to repent for their practices and for the policies, but don't talk to me much about repentance unless there are active measures to repair and to reorder the relationships of people beyond consideration of race. So I'm looking forward to seeing whether the words about repentance will mean that worship services will now be services that are across racial lines, whether the power and the authority in the church will be integrated in terms of its leadership, and also whether policies of the church will be strongly committed to the building of non-racial societies. That's what I will be watching for in the days ahead.
Well, I want to thank you all very much for joining us. Reverend Dr. James Forbes, head of New York's Riverside Church, one of the largest multicultural congregations in the country. Dr. Dolores Williams, professor of theology and culture at Union Theological Seminary, also here in New York, and author of Sisters in the Wilderness. We've been joined by Dr. Jack Shelton from Selma, Alabama, an ordained Presbyterian minister who runs the Program for Rural Services and Research in Alabama. And finally, earlier, Jim Wallace, author of Who Speaks for God? and founding editor of Sojourners. If you'd like to get in touch with Sojourners magazine or call to renewal, Christians for a New Political Vision, you can call in Washington, D.C. 202-328-8842. That's 202-328-8842. And finally, what happens when you cross the TV show Touched by an Angel with the holiday favorite movie It's a Wonderful Life? The oh-so-politically correct players present Touched by a Wonderful Life, a Christmas story for the 90s.
It all started in the heavens when the angels started talking.
Oh, please, God, please. I only want my wings. I've been trying for so long. Oh, Josephine, I beg of you. You're the top angel. Can't you get the big guy to help me out?
I don't know. Who ever heard of an angel with an Irish accent? You'll be doing most of your work in the United States, and they like all those all-American types. John Wayne, John, and John Travolta.
Just give me my wings and you'll see. Why, the Americans are suckers for anything foreign. They just love us. Oh, think about Haagen-Dazs, creme brulee, Irish Spring.
But Irish angels? I don't know, Clara.
Oh, please. I'll do anything.
All right, Clara. You're going to have to produce a miracle. I hear that Bill Clinton has made a mess out of welfare reform, and poor women are suffering throughout America. We've been hearing lots of prayers concerning one woman named Bella Bailey, who's having an especially hard time. Look down to the earth, and you'll see her.
Oh, yes, I do see her. I'm looking down across the plain plains of America, and I see her plainly. Oh, look at that sweet face. I like her already.
Well, my little angel in waiting, if you save Bella Bailey, you'll not only get your wings, you might also get your own primetime television series.
Oh, really? Oh, on what network? Thank you. You're too kind. Do you really think the good Lord would do that for little old me?
Well, it's possible, but you've got to focus on helping Bella Bailey.
Why, what's the matter with her? Is she sick?
Worse, she's discouraged. She's about to have to navigate her way through the welfare system, and that could destroy just about anybody. But let me tell you her story.
So Josephine told the Irish angel-in-waiting about poor Bella Bailey, how Bella had grown up the oldest of 7 children in anywhere USA, a small corn-fed town in the Midwest, how she'd gone to work at the age of 14 for the I Am Rich Potter chicken pickin' pluckin' factory owned by the meanest, greediest guy in town, how she was married at 16, pregnant at 17, and then widowed at 18 when her husband dropped dead from a rare disease related to ingesting chicken fat, and how, as a single mom, Bella still always found time to run the town's food bank, counsel friends in need, and even milk the neighbor's cows. But now, as the angels looked down upon her, they saw Bella in a desperate situation in her boss's office. Listen to what they heard.
You called, sir?
Yes. As you know, I am rich, and you're not.
Yes, I know. I'm Bella Bailey. You asked to see me.
I did? Bailey. Yes, here you are under the bees. Oh, I see your mother worked here, your father worked here, your husband worked here, and you've been here, 20 years. Good. Well, you're fired. Send in the next clown.
What? You can't do this. I've given you my loyalty.
Loyalty? What do you think I am, the Boy Scouts? I care about money, not an oath of loyalty. If I cared about charity, I'd be a church deacon, not a businessman.
But I have a child to support.
Honey, the only child I care about is my inner one. And if it tells me to make a good investment, I do. Now get out of here.
You can't do this. You can't treat people like we're your chickens ready for slaughter. You'll pay for this.
And who's going to make me pay? I own the factory, the bank, and everything in town. Good luck finding a job.
Bella was devastated. She went from one employer to the next, searching for a job in anywhere, but she couldn't find one anywhere. She got a few months of unemployment benefits, but those quickly disappeared. Finally, feeling defeated, without hope in her heart, she went to the welfare office, and much to her surprise, look who she found behind the counter.
Mr. I. M. Rich Potter? What are you doing here?
Oh, well, perhaps I forgot to tell you, I took over the welfare office yesterday, just in time to help you. You want some welfare benefits? I'm afraid you're just going to have to work for them.
What do you mean? I've been searching for jobs everywhere within a 100-mile radius of anywhere. And if I could find a good job, I wouldn't need welfare, would I?
Well, very interesting indeed. But you can't get welfare benefits unless you work, or at least work off your benefits.
What do you mean?
You've heard about the new workfare requirements, haven't you? Well, if you want your measly $130 monthly benefits, then you'll need to work 35 hours a week somewhere. And since you can't find a job in anywhere that pays you, I guess you'll just need to work for me for free.
What? Are you crazy? You fired me, and now you want to hire me back for nothing? You mangy weasel!
You flatter. Yes, yes, it's a wonderful life, isn't it? I can downsize my entire workforce, then bring in welfare mothers to replace those jobs, and I don't have to pay anyone a dime! I can treat you all the way I want because there's no laws to cover unpaid workers. This is what I call fairness, justice, and the American way!
No! You can't get away with this. I'd rather live on the streets than grovel to you, Mr. Rich Potter. You are just a pathetic, lonely old miser who wants to make sure that you make everyone else as miserable as you are.
But I am rich, 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 and that's what's important.
Bella ran out to the streets of anywhere, tears streaming down her sweet face. She looked up to the heavens and cried out,
"Oh, dear God, if you are listening today, you must help me. I'm not a praying woman, but I need your guidance. I can't allow Mr. I. M. Rich Potter to treat us so shabbily. I must do something."
Hello, Bella. I'm Clara, and I've come here for you.
What? Who are you?
Well, I'm your guardian angel, and I have been sent from the heavens to help you.
How can you be an angel? You don't have any wings.
Well, I'll only get my wings if I help you.
I don't know what you can do. Oh, I feel so all alone.
Oh, no, 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 no. That's where you're wrong, Bella. You're never alone if you have community. So look behind you there, darling. There, near the shimmering lake, and behold a godly sight.
My goodness! It's all my fellow factory workers, and my family and friends, and, oh, gosh, even the cows from next door.
Oh, yes, Bella. And they've all come to help you. You see, if you all pool your money together in a community bank, let's say, then you can build your own factory and then compete with Mr. I. M. Rich Potter. You can pay yourself livable wages and health care benefits, and then you can lobby your legislators to repeal those very stupid welfare workfare requirements to make them fairer to poor people.
Gosh, Clara, that's very nice of you to help me, but aren't you supposed to let me figure this out on my own?
Oh, well, ordinarily, yes, Bella. But we're running out of time, and, well, I'm pretty anxious to move on.
Oh, you want those wings, huh, Clara?
Yeah, and I'm late for the taping of my new show on Sunday night television. Well, bye-bye. But remember, every time you hear a bell ringing, another angel gets her wings and a new TV series.
Bye-bye, Clara, and thanks. You know, that red-haired Irish angel is pretty sappy, but she's smart. Way to go, Clara.
Karen Friedman and the oh-so-politically-correct players. Well, that about does it. If you'd like a copy of today's show, you can call 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. Tomorrow on Democracy Now!, we'll look at Peru, Friday, the Guatemala Peace Accord, which will be signed on Sunday, and Monday on Democracy Now!, a special tribute to Yip Harburg. His name may not ring a bell, but I bet his songs do. Brother, Can You Spare a Dime?, The Wizard of Oz, and Finian's Rainbow, just to name a few. Then on Tuesday, well, it's New Year's Eve, and we'll be taking a look back at 1996, and we'd like to include you. What do you think the best and the worst of 1996 was? Why don't you give us a call, and we'll record it on our comment line at 202-588-0999, extension 313. That's 202-588-0999, extension 313. Democracy Now! Is produced by Julie Drizin, Dan Coughlin, and Errol Maitland. Errol Maitland also engineered this show. I'm Amy Goodman for this holiday edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!